Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 560, titled Economics 911. This program is being recorded on July 9th of the year 2006. And again, before we plunge into the main elements of argument here, please be aware of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the vast amount of material on that website and linked websites, material both in print and audio, because those of you who are only listening to the For the Record broadcasts themselves are missing the vast amount of the For the Record experience, to coin a term. So please take advantage of those websites. Now, inside one of the program, we were taking a look at how the corporatist slash free market economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, the Afghan Mujahideen, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, among other groups, an Islamic fascist group with a heritage stretching back to the World War II period and before, we took a look at how the corporatist slash free market economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood is at one with the globalized, laissez-faire economic philosophy of not only the Bush administration, but more importantly, the corporate elements behind the Bush administration. This should not be dealt with in a facile way, because it's a political slash economic landscape that is as complex as it is deadly. But nonetheless, I think in an attempt to unravel some of these complexities, it's important to understand not only the philosophical points of alignment between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bush administration, its enemy on the battlefield, but one should also understand that there are strong investment connections as well. In particular, with the rise in oil prices over the last 30-plus years, a tremendous amount of capital has gone into the coffers of the Arab oil-producing nations, and in turn, they have reinvested in a profound way in Western economies. And that reinvestment, not just economies, but also in non-commercial institutions, funding university Middle Eastern studies programs, a lot of that money has been recycled into the Western economy and is having a profound effect. So when we look, for example, at the Islamic Institute of Karl Rove and Grover Norquist, that is an institution which is a point of intersection between the Muslim Brotherhood and the GOP. It also is an outgrowth of the strong investment connections between many of the Middle Eastern oil kingdoms and corporate elements in the United States and elsewhere. At the end of side two, we were looking at an article from a website, a defense website, that noted the hypocrisy of the Bush administration bashing the New York Times for having revealed some details about the SWIFT program. Well, the Bush administration has not only been touting its attempts at interdicting terror finance for a long time, but in fact, when Operation Green Quest got underway and when the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids were conducted as a result of a lawsuit filed by the heroic John Loftus and also another equally heroic person, a woman named Rita Katz, who wrote a book called Terrorist Hunter under the pseudonym of Anonymous. Rita Katz did a lot of the bedrock research for the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids. What those raids revealed were profound connections between the Muslim Brotherhood terror financing apparatus in the United States and the GOP and people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. Those investigations were initially conducted under the auspices of Treasury. Treasury Secretary O'Neill was fired X number of months after those raids were conducted. He basically got a dressing down from Talat Altman, a member of the board of directors of Bush's Harkin Energy Company, a key member of the Norquist Karl Rove Islamic Institute, and somebody who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000. Basically, Talat Altman told then Treasury Secretary O'Neill, hands off of the people that you are dealing with. And indeed, not much came of the Operation Green Quest raids. We should also note that if those raids had been properly followed up on, then they would have led to, among other things, Yaqub Mirza. Yaqub Mirza set up the core various fronts that were raided on March 20th, and also the Muslim Brotherhood funding institutions in the United States, and yet he was never arrested. even though he set up these basically enemy institutions in the United States. Yaqub Mirza also is a key director of PTEC, and if one investigates Operation GreenQuest properly, one also comes across the PTEC firm and the anomalous performance of air defense units on September 11th can in many ways, I suspect, be explained by the fact that the threat assessment software architecture for the Air Force and the FAA, among other institutions, was developed by PTEC, which is, for all intents and purposes, a Muslim Brotherhood-financed corporation. I would note that, as we have seen in, among other programs, For the Record 454, after the Operation Green Quest raids, elements of FBI and CIA cracked down on the people who, like Rita Katz and John Loftus, who would actually help to launch the Operation Green Quest raids. I'll put citations in the description for this broadcast. So again, one should note the ironies surrounding Operation Green Quest and the tremendous hypocrisy of the Bush administration in bashing the New York Times. What we're going to look at next concerns Osama bin Laden as a de facto Bush ally, or maybe it should be viewed as the other way around. As Robert Perry, the heroic investigative journalist who runs the ConsortiumNews.com website, has noted, there is a symbiosis between bin Laden and Bush. As I noted, well before the 2000 election. In fact, the bin Ladens and the Bushes were investment partners. But even beyond that, the political agendas of George Bush and Osama bin Laden dovetail in a number of very interesting ways. And again, underlying that, I suspect, at least in part, is the fact that the economic interests behind Osama bin Laden and George Bush are the same, not only underground Reich economic interests, but the Muslim Brotherhood's Islamic fascist and free market agenda as well. And indeed, when George Bush goes around touting democracy, even as he and the elements he represents are undermining democracy or what's left of it in the United States, fixing elections, intimidating opponents, and generally disregarding constitutional authority, Bush is touting democracy in areas around the world, such as the Middle East, and what is coming to power in these newly empowered, quote, democracies, unquote, is the fascist Muslim Brotherhood with its free market, globalized, laissez-faire economic philosophy, something very dear to the hearts of people like George Bush and Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. One of the things that Robert Perry has noted in a recent posting on his ConsortiumNews.com website is a CIA analysis of an address that Osama bin Laden released 4 days before the 2004 election. This article is titled, CIA, Osama Helped Bush in 2004. It's by Robert Perry. It's dated July 4th of 2006. It reads in part as follows. On October 29th, 2004, just 4 days before the U.S. presidential election, al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden released a videotape denouncing George W. Bush. Some Bush supporters quickly spun the diatribe as Osama's endorsement of John Kerry, unquote. But behind the walls of the CIA, analysts had concluded the opposite, that bin Laden was trying to help Bush gain a second term. This stunning CIA disclosure is tucked away in a brief passage near the end of Ron Suskind's The 1% Doctrine, which draws heavily from CIA insiders. Suskind wrote that the CIA analysts based their troubling assessment on classified information, but the analysts still puzzled over exactly why bin Laden wanted Bush to stay in office. According to Suskind's book, CIA analysts had spent years, quote, parsing each expressed word of the al-Qaeda leader and his deputy, Zawahiri. What they learned over nearly a decade is that bin Laden speaks only for strategic reasons. Quote, there, the CIA's assessments at day's end are a distillate of the kind of secret internal conversations that the American public was not sanctioned to hear. Strategic analysis. Today's conclusion, bin Laden's message was clearly designed to assist the president's re-election. Let me interject at this point that in past analysis of the Bush/bin Laden rhetorical exchanges, I noted not only that an alleged al-Qaeda offshoot, an organization called the Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigade, had a public communique in which they stated in no uncertain terms that Bush was a tremendous asset for their movement, and they would do nothing to threaten his reelection because they considered him to be such an asset. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had a similar pronouncement, basically saying that that Bush, with his various policies, was assisting the Islamist cause. And in light of some of the discussion that we engaged in on side one, I think one should view not only what I just said, but what we're about to read in a greater and deeper perspective. Returning once again to CIA, Osama helped Bush in 2004. Quote, at the 5 o'clock meeting, Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin opened the issue with the consultants with the consensus view. Bin Laden certainly did a nice favor today for the president, unquote. McLaughlin's comment drew nods from CIA officers at the table. Jamie Mischick, a CIA Deputy Associate Director for Intelligence, suggested that the al-Qaeda founder may have come to Bush's aid because bin Laden felt threatened by the rise in Iraq of Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Bin Laden might have thought his leadership would be diminished if Bush lost the White House and their eye-to-eye struggle, unquote, ended. But the CIA analysts also felt that bin Laden might have recognized how Bush's policies, including the Guantanamo prison camp, the Abu Ghraib scandal, and the endless bloodshed in Iraq, were serving al-Qaeda's strategic goals for recruiting a new generation of jihadists. Certainly, unquote, the CIA's Mischick said, he would want Bush to keep doing what he's doing for a few more years, unquote, according to Susskind's account of the meeting. As their internal assessments sank in, the CIA analysts drifted into silence, troubled by the implications of their own conclusions. Quote, an ocean of hard truths before them, such as what did it say about U.S. policies that bin Laden would want Bush reelected, remained untouched, unquote, Susskind wrote. One immediate consequence of bin Laden breaking nearly a year of silence to issue the videotape the weekend before the U.S. presidential election was to give the Bush campaign a much-needed boost. From a virtual dead heat, Bush opened up a 6-point lead, according to one poll. The implications of this new evidence are troubling, too, for the American people as they head toward another election in November 2006 that also is viewed as a referendum on Bush's prosecution of the, quote, war on terror, unquote. As we have reported previously at consortiumnews.com, a large body of evidence already existed supporting the view that the Bushes and the bin Ladens have long operated with a symbiotic relationship that may be entirely unspoken, but nevertheless has been a case of each family acting in ways that advance the interests of the other. Before al-Qaeda launched the September 11, 2001 terror attacks against New York and Washington, Bush was stumbling in a presidency that many Americans felt was headed nowhere. As Bush took a month-long vacation at his Texas ranch in August of 2001, his big issue was a plan to restrict stem cell research on moral grounds. Privately, Bush's neoconservative advisors were chafing under what they saw as the complacency of the American people, unwilling to take on the mantle of global policemen as the world's sole superpower. The neocons hoped for some Pearl Harbor, unquote, incident that would galvanize a public consensus for actions against Iraq and other, quote, rogue states, unquote. Other senior administration officials, such as Vice President Dick Cheney, dreamed of the restoration of the imperial presidency that, after Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal, had been cut down to size by Congress, the courts, and the press. Only a national crisis would create cover for a new assertion of presidential power. Meanwhile, halfway around the world, bin Laden and his al-Qaeda militants were facing defeat after defeat. Their brand of Islamic fundamentalism had been rejected in Muslim societies from Algeria and Egypt to Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Bin Laden and his lieutenants had even been expelled from the Sudan. Bin Laden's extremists had been chased to the farthest corners of the planet, in this case the caves of Afghanistan. At this critical juncture, al-Qaeda's brain trust decided that their best hope was to strike at the United States and count on a clumsy reaction that would offend the Islamic world and rally angry young Muslims to al-Qaeda's banner. So by early summer 2001, the clock ticked down to 9/11 as 19 al-Qaeda operatives positioned themselves inside the United States and prepared to attack. But U.S. intelligence analysts picked up evidence of al-Qaeda's plans by sifting through the chatter, unquote, of electronic intercepts. The U.S. warning system was, quote, blinking red. unquote. Over the weekend of July 4th, 2001, a well-placed U.S. intelligence source passed on a disturbing piece of information to then-New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who later recounted the incident in an interview with Alternet. "The person told me that there was some concern about an intercept that had been picked up," Miller said. "The incident that had gotten everyone's attention was a conversation between two members of Al-Qaeda. As they had been talking to one another, supposedly expressing disappointment that the United States had not chosen to retaliate more seriously against what had happened to the destroyer USS Cole, which was bombed on October 12, 2000, quote, and one Al-Qaeda operative was overheard saying to the other, 'Don't worry, we're planning something so big now that the U.S. will have to respond.'" Unquote. It's interesting that Judith Miller got jailed and basically had her career destroyed over the Valerie Plame leak. She didn't write anything about that. And Robert Novak, who did, and he's Robert Novak being an administration shill, has done no time at all. At some point, we're going to tackle the Valerie Plame situation. I think it's far more complex than we have been told. But do note there the Judith Miller situation. Again, I've noted in connection with the Iraq invasion that basically the U.S. fell into a trap. I don't think it took a lot of guile to set such a trap. I think in light of the tenor of this administration, I think it took about as much skill as setting out a pot of honey in front of a marauding bear. The bear's going to go for it, and sure enough, in this case, the bear went for it. But again, I would note that Bush is actually furthering the agenda of bin Laden. And I suspect, I believe very firmly that the elements pulling both Bush's strings and the elements pulling bin Laden's strings are one and the same. At one level, the multinational corporate community. At another level, the Saudi oil interests, heavily invested in the multinational corporate community. And at the most profound level, the underground Reich, which with its Japanese fascist allies came to dominate the multinational corporate community as a result of the economic outcome of World War II. Japan and Germany lost on the battlefield, but they acquired the control over the liquid wealth of both Europe and Asia, so they won economically and politically. Considering Bush and bin Laden and the danse macabre in which they have both involved all of us to one extent or another, note the following article. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, June 29th of 2006. It's an article by Bob Deans of the Cox News Service headlined, U.S. Losing Fight Against Terrorism, Security Experts Say. And in this article and in the previous article, I think regular listeners, will recognize many themes, many things that I have been saying as well. Now, elements far more powerful and far more influential than yours truly are beginning to say the same things, including people from the Council on Foreign Relations in Foreign Policy magazine. The following article reads in part, "The United States is losing its fight against terrorism, and the Iraq War is the biggest reason. More than 8 of 10 American terrorism and national security experts concluded in a poll released Wednesday." One participant in the survey, a former CIA official who describes himself as a conservative Republican, said the war in Iraq has provided global terrorist groups with a recruiting bonanza, a valuable training ground, and a strategic beachhead at the crossroads of the oil-rich Persian Gulf and Turkey, the traditional land bridge linking the Middle East to Europe. Quote, "The war in Iraq broke our back in the war on terror," unquote, said the former official Michael Scheuer, the author of Imperial Hubris, a book highly critical of the Bush administration's anti-terrorism strategy and tactics. "It has made everything more difficult and the threat more existential," unquote. I think at a military/analytical level, the Muslim Brotherhood and its various offshoots from Al-Qaeda to Hamas to Palestinian Islamic Jihad could be viewed as proxy warriors being used by the underground Reich against, among other elements, the U.S. and also Israel. But note that some of the areas such as Iraq, where we have now seen U.S. arms bringing a Muslim fundamentalist to power, the economy of Iraq under Saddam Hussein was rather like the economy of Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser or the Syrian economy. Although there is some private enterprise, it was in many ways state-controlled. No longer, because as noted in the very first article that we read from Newsweek, the Shia-dominated government in Iraq barely revised the free market blueprint for that country drawn up by Grover Norquist, an ally of the a member of the Islamic Institute and an ally of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. In assessing Economics 911, one cannot overlook the petroleum industry and the implications of these various events for the petroleum industry. The more time has passed, the more I've come to believe that it is the violence itself, it is the instability itself in this key strategic region that in many ways is the most important goal of some of the macro-political and macroeconomic forces that are guiding the chaos, if indeed chaos could be guided. Because it is that very instability, it is the combat in Iraq, the threat of war, even perhaps nuclear war with Iran, and that instability that is driving up oil prices. And it is the increase in oil prices that is basically affecting a huge, huge global-wide transfer of wealth. One of the things that led to the political reaction of the late 1970s and early 1980s, and specifically embodied in the ascent of Margaret Thatcher in Britain, was the collapse of center and center-left social democracies throughout Europe and also elsewhere in the world, precipitated by the enormous increase in oil prices as a result of the 1973 Arab oil embargo. Everything and everybody on Earth uses petroleum directly or indirectly. And with the increase in oil prices as a result of the Arab oil embargo of 1973, a ripple effect took place throughout the industrialized world, and those institutions least able to absorb the inflationary increase as a result of oil prices were squeezed or in many cases decimated. It is still not understood by most people how political reaction, the profound political reaction embodied by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, was in many ways an outgrowth of the economic effects of the Arab oil embargo. And once again, as oil prices are soaring, we are looking at a tremendous transfer of wealth. If you, say, for the sake of argument, if you were a thief, and you wanted to rob everybody on the face of the earth on a daily basis, well, you're not going to be able to mug everybody on the face of the earth, stick a gun in their face, and say, your money or your life. On the other hand, if you jack up the price of oil because everybody uses it directly or indirectly, you are affecting a hands-on transfer of wealth from every individual and every institution in this country. And that wealth is going into the hands of some truly foul interests, from the Saudis and Islamo-fascists to the petroleum-related interests in this country as well. And by the way, too, it's sort of interesting to see Saudi Arabia portrayed as some sort of helpless third-world victim. For people who are viewing that, just bear in mind, sort of political shorthand, in the late 1990s, the Saudis hired an American neo-Nazi, William Grimstead, as a Washington lobbyist. So it's kind of funny because when one criticizes the Saudis, there are elements in the so-called progressive sector in this country that label one a racist or a bigot, which is really ironic. The Saudis hired an American Nazi as a Washington lobbyist. That's rather bigoted. We're obviously, due to the limitations of time, going to have to go into some of the oil links here at greater length. Perhaps I'll do another in my series of broadcasts about trouble on oiled waters. But note the following. This is from the Financial Times of London of Monday, May 15th of 2006. This is an article by Guy Dinmore in Washington, headlined, U.S. Must Beware Rise in Al-Qaeda Oil Strikes. The U.S. and its Arab allies must expect an increase in attacks on their oil infrastructure in the next phase of the war by Al-Qaeda targeting the U.S. economy, the former Central Intelligence Agency official who was responsible for hunting down Osama bin Laden warns today. Writing for the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington security think tank, Michael Scheuer says Mr. bin Laden's intention to bankrupt the U.S. economy by driving up world oil prices is very likely to lead to attacks inside the U.S. by Al-Qaeda, its allies, or unrelated groups. Houston's gas refineries, oil import facilities, and ship canal and pipeline systems, and the Trans-Alaska pipeline are potential targets. Al-Qaeda's failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abqaiq facilities on February 24th, which led to a $2 a barrel jump in world oil prices, should also be seen as the beginning of a new and more systematic phase of targeting of the kingdom's oil infrastructure. 2 days after the attack, an al-Qaeda-affiliated cleric issued a religious justification for attacking oil processing installations. The cleric, using the internet, also claimed that attacks on prominent Muslim oil officials were justified. The militant organization's media apparatus is also being used, quote, to stir the troubled pot of oil-related international worries, unquote, Mr. Scheuer writes, noting encouragement for Nigerian insurgents in the Niger Delta and Mujahideen in the Caspian Sea region. Tracing al-Qaeda's evolving strategy, Mr. Scheuer, who left the CIA in 2004, notes that Mr. bin Laden has never threatened to cut oil supplies to the U.S. Instead, he is driven by the belief that Muslim oil is bought too cheaply. In December 2004, Mr. bin Laden wrote that a minimum of $100 a barrel was a fair price, unquote. In his September 1996 Declaration of War Against Americans, unquote, Mr. bin Laden argues that oil in the Islamic world is a treasure to be preserved for future generations of Muslims and thus should not be wasted through attacks. As a result, Mr. Scheuer says al-Qaeda's plans rule out attacks on oil wells, but focus on the infrastructure needed for refining and transporting oil as well as industry personnel. And of course, an increase in the price of oil is certainly not going to be something that would be anathema to two former petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas, one of them a fellow by the name of George Bush, another a fellow by the name of Dick Cheney, currently the president and vice president of the United States. Again, we're going to explore the effect of all of this violence, from sort of the macroeconomic effects of the violence in the Middle East. Again, many people, and initially myself as well, when we're looking, for example, at the invasion of Iraq, saying, well, you know, the U.S. wants to gain control of oil, among other things. There's also been rumination about first Iraq and then Iran pricing oil in euros. I would look beyond that. As things develop, look at the violence itself. Watch what happens to the price of oil when, say, Cy Hirsch writes an article in The New Yorker about military contingency plans to bomb Iran. Watch what happens. And often note that many of the people who are in a position to leak stuff like that have access to the corridors of power, and they could also enter the market short and make a whole lot of money on oil futures. So watch that carefully. We're going to come back to this subject in future broadcasts. This, however, concludes side two of this program. Do not fail to take advantage of the tremendous amount of material on the web. www.spitfirelist.com. Check the For the Record section for long article-length descriptions of each broadcast. A dozen or so great old anti-fascist books available for download for free. Links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU that have the whole For the Record series on audio. Other websites as well, blog spots, website with the Bush, the declassified government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. And also, last but certainly not least, there is a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. And unfortunately, I don't get bankrolled by the Muslim Brotherhood or the multinational corporations or the Saudis or the oil companies. Too bad. But that leaves me to my own devices, so if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 560, Economics 911, being recorded on July 9th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.